Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. What are the greatest inventions of evolution? The eye? Opposable thumbs? Not quite. Biochemist Nick Lane is on hand to give us the lowdown on everything from sex to photosynthesis, why we have hot blood to the emergence of consciousness. We'll take you on a tour of ancient artifacts from the Islamic world, which all shaped science and are now on display at the Science Museum in London. And in the return of the news jam, we'll go through the latest health benefits of omega-3 oils, dangers lurking in your sofa, and how British men could all at heart be farmers. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. In the pod with me today are The Observer's science editor, Robin McKee, and The Guardian science correspondent, Ian Sample. Welcome to you all.
Hi, Alok.
Hi.
Now, we're going to talk about the dangers of sofas in a while, which Ian will take us through in the news jam. But before we get to that, what are the other dangers lurking in homes from a scientific perspective?
Well, there's my wife's loaded 12-bore shotgun. That's really dangerous.
Not so how scientific that is. No. Ian, what's dangerous in your home?
Stairs, of course. The steps are not as big as a foot. It's just inherent danger.
Maybe you've just got very large feet. Do you fall down them? No, I'm not going to go down this road. Our special guest this week is Nick Lane. He's a biochemist at University College London and has written extensively on subjects as varied as mitochondria and oxygen. His latest book, Life Ascending, looks at some of the specific biological innovations made in the course of evolution. Nick, welcome to the podcast.
Hello.
Now, before we go into all of this, let's be clear about something. You're not expounding some creationist line about evolution.
No, not at all.
Coming up with 10 great ideas, are you?
No, I mean, the word invention is a slightly tricky word to have used in the title. I have got some flack for it.
Innovation, maybe.
Well, I don't like the word innovation, and actually evolutionists always talk among themselves about inventions, and it's a much better word. It's a strong word, and to me, it doesn't imply an inventor, if you look it up in the Oxford English Dictionary or something. It can be defined without implying an inventor, so that's the sense in which I've used it.
Well, let's get the creationism out of the way in that case, then. Right, onto the meat of the book, then. There's 10 chapters here, each one talking about an invention of evolution. And I'm going to start with photosynthesis. You start that chapter by saying, what would the world be like if photosynthesis had never come along?
Well, it would be like Mars, in fact, almost certainly, because the oxygen in the atmosphere all comes from photosynthesis, and without that, you tend to bleed the oceans away into space, because ultraviolet radiation can split water slowly but continuously. The oxygen is released very slowly by that process and tends to react with iron and so on and turn the topsoils red, as happens on Mars, and the hydrogen just bleeds off into space. So eventually a planet can lose its oceans that way.
Photosynthesis manages to keep the water on the planet. What else does it do? I mean, obviously, the planet wouldn't be green, as you said, it'd be red. You wouldn't have plants, and then you wouldn't have life.
Well, you wouldn't have any large animals or any large plants. I mean, all of them require oxygen, and there simply isn't another chemical which is capable of producing as much energy when it reacts with other compounds as oxygen does. So really nothing else can do it.
I mean, photosynthesis itself, when you learn it at school, is a very sort of simple reaction. It's about the combination of carbon dioxide and sunlight with other chemicals to make sugar, and then the plants and give out oxygen as a sort of byproduct. Clearly it's not as simple as that. I mean, it's an incredibly complicated reaction involving a very, very complicated three-dimensional molecule in chlorophyll. I mean, give us a sense of how complicated it is.
Well, I mean, in terms of the biochemistry, it's enormously complicated. In a way, though, that's not the point of the book. It's not the point of the invention. The point of the invention, to me, is why choose water? Because what photosynthesis actually does is split water, and it takes the electrons from water and it adds those onto carbon dioxide. So that's what it's doing. That's how it's making sugar from the sunlight. It uses the sunlight to split water, and the oxygen comes from water. And that's been known for 80 years or something, but somehow it doesn't really sink through into people's minds somehow. And it's a very strange thing to do, to pick on water. It's very difficult to break water. I mean, you look at a storm in the ocean or something, you're not splitting water by that. So what were the advantages of choosing water over and above the things that were available, which were much easier to split? Things like hydrogen sulfide gas, for example, sewer gas, the Americans call it. Iron. I mean, iron dissolves in water when it's not oxidized, so it precipitates out as rust when it's oxidized, but when it's not oxidized, it sits there in the water. And so there's plenty of iron for the greater part of the Earth's history dissolved in the oceans. It's a very good thing to use as a source of electrons for photosynthesis.
The other thing about photosynthesis, of course, is that as we understand more about it, and it's taken a long time, it could potentially be used as an inspiration for future fuels for us.
Absolutely,
yes. Because if we can split water, create hydrogen, we've got our own sort of hydrogen economy for free.
Absolutely. I wish that there were more work going ahead on that. I mean, we seem to be looking in the wrong direction as far as I'm concerned about alternative energy. Splitting water is the answer to me.
Okay, well, let's move on to another one. Sex. You call this the greatest lottery on earth. We can probably all understand why you've called it that. And of course, evolution itself, this mixing of genes, the new traits appearing, wouldn't appear if you didn't have sexual reproduction. But what was the kind of invention of it? I mean, surely this was something that was always going to happen, because if you're going to have evolution, you need this to happen. Cloning wasn't going to be enough.
Well, curiously, that's perhaps the view that was common a few years ago. But the realization that bacteria, they don't have sex in the same way that more complicated cells do, but they do swap genes, and it amounts to a form of sex. It's called lateral gene transfer, or just bacterial sex, if you like. And it serves much the same purpose. And so the question is, when you're able to reproduce clonally, as bacteria do, and get all the extra variation that you need by just picking it up from the environment, why go through this long, complicated process that's sex for larger organisms?
Which has energy costs. I mean, you talk about the peacock's tail, for example, which is just about display and obviously, it is about attracting mates. You talk about things like flowers, which are nothing
pure
but...
Pure cost, yes.
Pure cost, exactly. So this must be something very useful.
I mean, the cost all comes down to what John Maynard Smith years ago called the twofold cost of sex, and that's effectively that the cost of producing males. Why have men? Because a clonal organism just simply splits in half and you have two offspring from a single parent, if you like, and sex reverses that. You have two parents who produce one child, and 50% of those are men. What's the point? So that's another serious...
Are we going to answer that question, what's the point of men? I was going to say, Robin, do you have any thoughts on why men exist, or sex generally, in this context?
Well, you're asking an old man here, you see. I've forgotten, sorry.
Ian, are there any chapters you've picked out that you could...
I did have quite a geeky question about photosynthesis, Nick. I was wondering, when you were talking about photosynthesis, whether when you look across the plant kingdom, and including algae as well, do they all use the same wavelength of light for photosynthesis? Because obviously there's more energy in shorter wavelengths of light, like ultraviolet, blues, violets, and things like that, than there is in red light. And I just wonder, do they all use the same thing? Or
they don't use the shorter wavelengths at all. They use red light in general, and they do vary, but within a fairly limited band, and that's why everything is green.
Wouldn't one imagine or expect evolution to exploit the fact that, you know, if you can pick up, you know, if you can essentially end up with what is an antenna for red light, you get more energy, more bang for your buck if you could pick up just a slightly shorter wavelength.
It's a curiosity. I think it's because the higher wavelengths have got more energy in them and therefore are more destructive. And the complexes
so you pick it up,
that
but you don't want what you're picking up.
Yeah, I think it simply fries the proteins involved, and so you use lower wavelengths. And that's why plants are green, is that you use the red light, you absorb the red light, and the blue and the yellow is reflected back, and you get green.
One of the other chapters in your book, which I thought was quite interesting, Nick, was you talked about consciousness. Now, consciousness if you really think about it, is of course the end product of something like evolution, because everything that we are is. But what we don't really know what consciousness is at the moment. How do you define it? And then how do you link it back to evolution?
I try to avoid defining it, in fact.
That's good.
it cost me a lot of work, the chapter. I've always been interested in consciousness. I've never really managed to solve it in any way. And in fact, the chapter stands out in the book as failing to solve it, really. I mean, in all the chapters I attempted to...
Give us a go of how you try to solve it then.
Well, I tried to deconstruct it, what actually consciousness is. I mean, I say I tried not to define it, but... It boils down, after all the ways in which neurons fire and so on, the central question is what philosophers call the hard question. It's the mind-body dichotomy again. How do neurons firing generate a feeling of anything? What is a feeling in biochemical terms? And it's very, very difficult to put your finger on that. And I think in that chapter, I spent the whole time worrying about how you do. There's two ways of going at it, really, as I see it. One of them is that it's a property of matter. All matter has some kind of subjective properties as well as the objective ones that we know about, and we simply can't see those. It's called panpsychism. It was popular 100 years ago, and it's becoming more popular again now. And it boils down to the more complex you are, the more consciousness you kind of just absorb. And then the other way, which I tend to favour myself, is that it's really just a property of neuronal networks. But that means that
feelings... Something emergent,
but it means effectively that it's coded, that feelings emerge simply from a code and are presumably illusory, which is also difficult to swallow.
Well, I guess there must be some evolutionary advantage to having consciousness,
yes.
Otherwise we wouldn't have it.
And I personally think that consciousness, in a very simple form, goes right back a very long way, certainly as far as bees and things like that. Insofar as you can test consciousness in any other animals, it's notoriously difficult to do. They do show certain signs of awareness of their environment and their place in it.
Ian, Robin, are there any other inventions of evolution you think may be worth Nick looking at for his next 10?
Well, I notice here that intelligence is not one of the 10. I mean, do you see that as really consciousness and intelligence somehow intertwined, or did we quite specific there and
yes.
Not rating big brains as that useful or that meaningful?
Again, I see them as intertwined, really. I don't know how possible it is to be intelligent without being conscious. I mean, you could argue that all day long with a philosopher, but I would tend to see them as intertwined and as consciousness being the substrate, if you like, for intelligence.
Ian?
Can I just ask you a bit more about these subjective properties you were talking about? It sounded as if you were getting a little bit mystical then, and I don't know whether this
yeah.
is... these are theories that were put forward in the past, or can you just...
Well, they were
that?
Put forward initially by William James, who was a noted father, if you like, of psychology, American. But they've been taken up again more recently, and a lot of quantum mechanical ideas of consciousness and so on. Again, I wouldn't describe them as mainstream, but they're certainly well known, they're certainly intriguing, and they do imply that there are properties of matter that we don't really understand and we don't know about. And the question really boils down to what is the output, if you like. I mean, if you think of a fax machine or something, you have an electrical power, and the output is, in terms of letters, it's a code. Everything's understood in terms of the physical requirements of it. But what is the output of consciousness? It's very difficult to define what it is in terms of the known properties of matter.
Okay, well, we're going to pause that conversation there. Nick's book, Life Ascending, is published by Profile Books and is out now. Let's take a look now at some of the science news from the past week. News
Jack. Fish oil may be the true elixir of youth. Omega-3 fatty acids from fish oil can preserve the genetic fuse that determines the lifespan of cells, say scientists. The discovery made in heart disease patients may explain many of the claimed health benefits of omega-3. Taking supplements of fish oil is said to protect against heart disease, reduce mental decline in old age, and help to prevent age-related changes in the eye that can lead to blindness. Research has also shown that rodents live one-third longer when given a diet enriched with fish-derived omega-3.
A common household chemical found in everything from sofas and carpets to pots and pans has been linked to an increased risk of thyroid disease. The substance, used to make non-stick cookware, stain-resistant furnishings and grease-proof wrappers, is believed to get into the body through contaminated food or household dust. Scientists said they cannot be certain the chemical is directly responsible for the rise in thyroid disease, but called for a full investigation to assess its safety.
The pharmaceutical company GlaxoSmithKline has said it will publish online the details of thousands of potential drugs that might cure malaria. Andrew Whitty, the British boss of the company, said in a major speech last week that multinational drug companies have to balance social responsibility alongside the need to make profits for their shareholders.
And finally, most men in Britain are descended from the first farmers to migrate across Europe from the Near East 10,000 years ago. Ancient farmers left their genetic mark on modern males by breeding more successfully than indigenous hunter-gatherer men as they made their way west, a study has found. As a result, more than 60% of British men, and nearly all of those in Ireland, can trace their Y chromosome back to the agricultural revolution, or more precisely, the sexual success of the men behind it.
Right, let's look at some of those stories in a bit more detail. Omega-3 health claims, Robin, we've had loads of these. There have been all sorts of questions about actually whether omega-3 oils do have any health effects. This latest study, what was the result of that first before we go into...
Suggested a mechanism by which omega-3 might introduce its benefits into people. We all have chromosomes inside ourselves. These are the packets of DNA that ensure cell replication and... good health. At the end of these chromosomes are little caps, a bit like the plastic ends of shoelaces. These are called telomeres, and as cells divide more and more often, these telomeres get shorter and shorter until sometimes they disappear and basically the DNA gets frayed. This is unhealthy. The study that has been done here suggests that those who take omega-3 fatty acids have longer telomeres and therefore their cells are in a healthier state.
And the particular study was in people with, I think, heart disease, or is that right?
Yes.
Yeah.
And they were given two fish-derived omega-3 fatty acids.
Now, there's all sorts of controversies about whether omega-3 oils are actually that useful in terms of things like mental ability. The people have put fish oils into milk. Nameless mustachioed scientists have endorsed that. Mm. I just wonder, Nick, what are your thoughts on omega-3s? Good or bad?
Well, I'm suspicious of antioxidants in general, to be quite honest. There have been so many large trials of antioxidants broadly that turn out to be negative. And smaller studies can be positive, but then you do another one and it's negative. And so you end up... It's very difficult to put much weight on
a single conundrum,
trial.
Isn't it? Because things like antioxidants are in all the foods that we're encouraged to eat, fruit, vegetables, all these things.
And there's no doubt that fruit and vegetables are good for your health. The question is it the antioxidants in them?
When you take the antioxidants out and do trials, they don't seem to show anything, really.
Yes. I mean, it may be that you need a balanced diet of antioxidants. It may be that the benefits of fruit and vegetables are not just about antioxidants, but other things too. Perhaps mild toxins, for example.
So
immune system on its toes.
After this study, then, are we still sort of slightly sceptical, Ian?
Completely. I mean, I think, as Nick was kind of alluding to, if there was a big effect, then we would be seeing it. And I think this study is quite interesting in that it does seem to say that if you have high levels of fish oils in your diet, then your telomeres shorten at a slower rate. But these guys are all being treated in hospital for having heart attacks. I mean, it's not like these aren't the most healthy people in the world, okay? And I know... It just means that shortening telomeres isn't necessarily a direct correlate for how long you're going to live, that's for sure. And I think that we can extrapolate that a bit too much.
Yeah, the other problem with telomeres is that the cells which really let us down as we're aging, the brain cells and the heart cells and so on, they're not dividing cells anyway, and so the telomeres technically are not shortening.
So we'll come to death, actually, at the end of the podcast as part of your book, actually, Nick. Let me move on to another potential problem in the home. Ian, this is your story about two chemicals with very long names that appear in all sorts of things in our houses and which could be causing all sorts of problems. Before we start, the headline for this is something like "The Dangers Lurking in Your Sofa." And may I just say that since 2004, I've held the prize in this place for the most ridiculous article on science, which was about how shelves can do damage to your health. And I think you've just taken that prize away from me with this one.
This is an interesting one, though, in that PFOA, which is perfluorooctanoic acid, is one of a group of chemicals that is used to make non-stick surfaces, but also flame retardants for furnishings. So that's where the sofa comes in. Things like stain-resistant coatings for carpets. It's used in making Gore-Tex and things like that. So it's a very ubiquitous industrial chemical. Now, sometimes it's used directly in things like in greaseproof wrappers for fried chicken and popcorn and things like that and pizzas. And sometimes it's just used as a chemical along the way to making something else. Like Teflon is made using this, but there's hardly any of it actually in Teflon at the end of the day. What this study did was, it was a big study. I mean, they looked at a huge database of medical records in the US. They found about 4,000 people who were all otherwise, well, generally healthy people, representative selection of people, and looked at levels of this chemical in their bloodstream and then divided them into sort of high and low groups. They actually have four different groups ranging from, depending on how high their levels were. And if you look at then to how they're faring medically. There was something like, well, it was 16% of the women had thyroid issues in the highest PFOA group, and those with the lowest levels in their blood had 8%, half the amount of thyroid disease. And thyroid diseases are far more common in women. They're about 10 times more common in women. So this study was suggesting that it's no, there's no, you can't say it's causal, but they're saying there seems to be a link between having a lot of PFOA in your blood and having thyroid disease.
Does this study then prove that PFOA causes thyroid, or is it just the tip of trying to get to that sort of stage?
It's, and we have to say, you know, the scientists who found this this link are not saying, ergo, we need to, you know, worry about this, and it's this is a cause and effect scenario. What they're saying is this is happening. We should find out why. And it's worth pointing out that it might be that if you have thyroid disease, that changes your body's metabolisms, which means that you end up with more accumulating more PFOA, or that your body clears PFOA less quickly than healthy people. So it could be completely reverse. It could be around the other way. And they don't know, and they're holding their hands up and saying, we don't know exactly what's going on, but they're saying we should look at it.
Robin, do you think this is another long-named chemical that everyone's going to now start being terrified of it unnecessarily?
Yes, probably is. It strikes me as the complete mirror reverse of the previous story we did, where you've got this chemical that suddenly does all these wonderful things and quite ridiculous claims are made for it. And here we've got a chemical that does all these terrible things, and we're going to be petrified of it. And in both cases, we have absolutely no causal mechanism involved. And really, you know, it's interesting and worth keeping an eye on, but no more than that.
Nick, the thing with causal mechanisms, this is what your job is, surely, to find these causal mechanisms.
It's very difficult to pin them down, but I mean, yes, it may simply be that people who are low in energy spend more time on the sofa and so pick up more of them. It could be as simple as that.
That's actually very true. Okay, well, on to other complex molecules. The chief exec of GlaxoSmithKline, one of the biggest drug companies in the world, is going to put 13,500 chemical compounds from its drug database into the public domain. 13,500 compounds which may help against malaria. Robin, is this drug company suddenly developing conscience or something?
Yes, probably is. I don't know how you balance that off against the need to keep your shareholders happy, though.
What I worry about is the 13,500 compounds. Just having a chemical molecule doesn't necessarily mean you get a drug out of it, or that it works, or you've got any way of actually making a drug from it, surely.
Well, you've got to screen it and find out how.
You've still got to have the machinery to do everything.
That's the job of a pharmaceutical.
The cynic in you probably would suggest that the 13,500 are things that they don't think are going to make them any money anyway, so why not just put them out there and get them from some free publicity? Am I just being a bit negative unnecessarily, Nick?
I would tend to agree with you. Having said that, though, I do think that the pharmaceutical industry has had a very bad press over the last decade or so, particularly, and I've been shocked at how few eloquent spokespeople for the pharmaceutical industry you hear on the radio. And I think from their point of view, they do need to do something, and this perhaps is a publicity stunt. But, you know, most of my own dealings with pharmaceutical companies in the past, you know, the people I've met have been perfectly reasonable human beings.
Ian?
I was just wondering if a small independent company, maybe sat on the outskirts of a university somewhere, goes screening these products and finds one that somehow takes out the malaria parasite, I would be amazed if it meant that they had complete IP, intellectual property rights over exploiting it. I mean, I would imagine that this is almost a way of farming out your work to other people, so that if they manage to get a hit on something, which, to be fair, a lot of people in the West aren't going to pay for, you know, I mean, this is malaria pills for travellers and WHO by the rest.
Nick, we're refusing to see the good in this at all. But one other thing that I'll say is, for example, without being cynical about the malaria stuff, the question is why aren't big drug companies also doing the same thing for HIV medicine, for example, for in Africa at least, never mind anywhere else? It seems like I think that Andrew Witty, the guy, the head of GlaxoSmithKline, who's done this releasing of the 13,500 molecules, argues that HIV is not something which is necessarily so urgent in terms of finding new cures for. I suppose that they've got their IP on it. They want to hold on to it because it makes them a lot of money.
Yes, that's probably right. I mean, I understand they also have some difficulties in Africa, or have had some difficulties politically in Africa and so on. But yes, I mean, the bottom line is always money, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they should be viewed on a par with the arms industry or something, for example. They're not directly evil.
I think that's a... Yeah, you're right. Ian, before we wind up the news jam, I've got one question. Last week, we tried to... we almost discussed dark matter and the discoveries by CDMS. Now, we ended up not discussing it because I said it was too hard, and we had an angry email saying, come on, you've got to do better than that. So you're the man who found this story last month. CDMS, quickly, take us through what happened. Have we discovered dark matter?
Okay, so this is one of the largest groups looking for cold dark matter in the universe. It makes up about 25% of the mass of the universe. And we can't see it, that's why they call it dark. It doesn't radiate or reflect light. Now, this was the result of a study which had been looking to try and pick up particles of dark matter. Basically, the detectors are underground. They're at the bottom of a mine, about a mile underground. And that's to shield them from all the other cosmic radiation coming in from coming in from space. And what you do is you try and look for signatures in your detector that aren't anything that we know of, and hopefully have the signature, the sort of energy, if you like, of dark matter particles. And over a good few months of searching, these guys found two particles which look as if they tick all the boxes of cold dark matter.
So you know my next question, what are the mass of these particles? What are the properties of these particles?
That's a really interesting question, because I asked the researchers, do you know what energy they're at? Because when we're talking about these kinds of particles, you talk in terms of energy, thanks to E equals MC squared. And they don't know, because the signature that you get doesn't allow you to understand the energy of the particles.
Something you don't understand? I recognise the feeling. All right. Well, Jeff Broomfield, I'm hoping you're happy with that. You can find out more on all those stories at guardian.co.uk/science. There's an unusual gig for Sir Ben Kingsley this week over at the Science Museum in London. He plays the 12th century Muslim engineer Al-Jazari in a short film that forms part of the museum's new 1001 Inventions exhibition. We went along to South Kensington to get a taste of what's being billed as the forgotten story of 1,000 years of science from the Muslim world.
Ah, hello. Hello. Gather round.
Welcome, my friend, welcome. Allow me to introduce myself.
My name is Abbas bin Furness, and as you can see, I am somewhat injured. But it's all for a good cause, I can assure you.
I'm Susan Mossman. I'm project director at the Science Museum, who are hosting this exhibition called 1001 Inventions, Discovering Muslim Heritage in Our World. This exhibition is from about 700 to 1700. It's covering an area of sort of, I suppose, science, technology, medicine, and hidden stories that perhaps we're not really that aware of.
Many call me the father of surgery, but that is an unwieldy title, I admit. Please, just call me Al-Zahrawi. I was born in the 10th century. I am a surgeon, as well as an inventor of useful medical instruments. But you are thinking that medical treatment back in my time must be very different to that of yours today. So you'll be surprised to hear that there are more similarities than you might think.
For me, working as a project director, and although there were little aspects that I knew from my expertise as a museum curator here, it opened my eyes to whole new areas. For example, the Houses of Wisdom in cities such as Baghdad and Damascus, where they were inviting scholars from a whole range of communities, societies, to come in and work with them. So it was sort of multicultural scholarly pursuits, translating ancient texts, Greek texts, into Arabic, which then could be worked on, developed, and moved on, and actually provided a continuum into the Renaissance. So it's sort of stepping stones through. So what we can trace, and certainly, for example, in astronomy, direct pathways through from the ancients through the Arabic world into the Renaissance and to influencing key astronomers such as Nicholas Copernicus and Kepler. So I think there's some lovely stories that people will be able to explore and learn about in this exhibition.
My name's Jamie. I'm from Crespo's Academy.
Hello, my name's Ali. I'm from Crespo's Academy too.
Oh, I just find it quite astonishing the way all these type of things came from an Islamic history, because I used to think that some of this was kind of made more modern days, not old-fashioned days like that.
I think I'll remember this place for quite a long time.
Yeah, I think I'd have a better way of thinking when I think of the Muslim culture.
I'm Professor Mohammed El Ghomati, the Professor of Electron Optics and Nanotechnology at the University of York. I'm the Deputy Chair of the Foundation for Science, Technology and Civilization. I'm a director of the 1001 Invention Company, which is behind this exhibition.
And you've brought me to an area of the exhibition where, well, first of all, there's this incredible and impressive elephant clock.
Yes.
But we're also looking here at the camera obscura. Yes. I think many people will be very surprised to learn of the real origins of this.
Yes, I mean, the camera obscura has come out of a bit of basic research that this gentleman called Al-Hasan ibn Haytham, back in the beginning of the 11th century, towards the end of the 10th century, started dabbling with. There were two theories of how do we see the process of vision. One saying that in the invisible rays come from the eye to the object and they're reflected back, and one saying, oh no, it comes from a reflection from the sun rays hitting the object and reflected, and depending on the medium, you will see it. And he said, well, I'm not quite sure about either of the two, but let me do an experiment. So he actually, I credit him with the experimental evidence as a proof of a theory. So there were two theories with no experimental evidence, and he really set up the camera obscura, which in Arabic was al-baytul muslim, and when it was translated into Latin, it became camera obscura. And now the Arabs are using the word camera, referring to the room or the dark room.
You mentioned a dark room there, yes. And it's interesting how a big theme of this exhibition is how much of this knowledge has remained in the dark. Why do you think we're so unaware of the real ancestry of many of these technological innovations?
Well, it's a matter of perspective, how people look at it. Yes, Europe at that time was not in the forefront. After the Romans empire going down, the Greek treasures were all almost lost. Hadn't been for the House of Wisdom in Baghdad, and looking at the many translators who knew Latin and who knew Greek and who knew other languages, who were able to translate all of these Greek books, and then the Muslims took them, and non-Muslims at the time took them and said, all right, do I understand what I'm reading? And they started questioning them in a very nice way and coming up with our understanding that we have built upon today. Unfortunately, for a very long time, people have ignored that root of science and belittled it. But what we're trying to do with this exhibition is to say to people, let's have an accurate understanding of the roots of science, who have contributed to it together. And I'm looking at this elephant clock, which is a celebration of at least five civilizations there, from the Indians to the Chinese, the Egyptians, the Arabs, all of them. And we are saying, I can see thus far because I'm standing on the shoulders of giants.
Okay, the game's like, you have to find all the objects that there were in the house in the olden times, and you have about 2 minutes to find all the objects, and I think there's about 12, 13 objects that you have to find in the whole game.
There is also it dispels some of the myths. Women. Do women have a role in within the Muslim world as scholars and scientists? The answer is yes, and a large yes.
Greetings. It is a pleasure to meet you. My name is Maryam Al-Astrolabi, and I lived in the 10th century. Don't ask how old I am. A lady never tells, you know that. I, like my father before me, spent my life studying astronomy and making astrolabes. But what is an astrolabe, I hear you ask? Well, think of it as a sophisticated navigation device, but like a computer, it had a wide range of uses. It could tell the time during the day, show you the direction of Mecca in the east, and even pinpoint the location of stars.
My name is Fatima Al-Fihri. Some call me Al-Fariya, and I was born over 1,000 years ago in the 9th century. A long time, yes? I establish what is now one of the oldest universities in the world, the University of El Karawiyin in Fez, Morocco. A surprise for many of you, I'm sure.
My name is Salim Al-Hassani. I am an emeritus professor at the University of Manchester. I am also the chairman of the Foundation for Science, Technology and Civilization, which has developed this 1001 inventions. There was a very peculiar feature of the Muslim civilization in that Muslims and non-Muslims worked in harmony with each other. There were scholars who were Jewish, scholars who were Christian, there were Sabians, there were Hindus. They all worked in harmony with Muslim scholars and scientists. There was no problem. There was no problem between science and religion in those days. But of course, things have moved on, and the political and the socio-economic situation in the world keep changing, as we now know. And these things have a factor on the movement of civilization. However, science in particular, and civilization in general, it moves in history. It goes from one culture to another, from one nation to another.
My name is Abbas bin Vernes. I am what you might describe as a 9th century daredevil. You see, I always had this dream. A dream that man could fly like a bird.
The religion at the time was, in fact, providing an incentive for people to go for discovery and to do useful deeds that improve the quality of life. When that understanding somehow changed, we find there was a different atmosphere and there was a decline. And we have, of course, the emergence of Europe, and Europe now is obviously at its peak. And we want to know, why did the Muslim civilization decline, so that we don't follow suit? But for the Muslim generation, they ought to be thinking of how they get out of that hole rather than how they got there.
That was Pascal Wise reporting from the Science Museum in London. Robin, you've had a quick look around this exhibit. What took your fancy?
I was very impressed with the whole edifice. At the entrance to the main exhibit, there's a sort of four cases of the Science Museum has got into its vaults and brought out some very nice historical instruments. But the meat of it is inside with these sort of great seven displays. But there's a couple that really struck me about the kind of illustrated the way that the Arab world held on to knowledge and the pursuit of knowledge after the ends of the Greek and Roman empires, and used Indian and Chinese learning, and then developed it in their own ways, and provided us with some quite, the extraordinary power of modern mathematics is one example. I was particularly struck by one display about the nature of the numerals we use, the numbers we use from 0 to 9. I thought the actual symbols that we use carried no meaning. But it's quite clear that the Arab scholars gave them meaning. If you look at a 0, it has no angles inside it, and therefore that's where it gets its meaning from. If you look at 1, it is a tiny tick at the top, and there's one angle in it. If you think of a 2 done as a straight lines as a Z, it has 2 angles in it. A 3, you add another tick, you've got 3. So the actual numbers that we use had a specific meaning. It's full of stuff like this. There's about 100 pages worth of material secreted around the place, and you could spend a long time there. At the same time, the kids would really enjoy it. There's some really, really good displays.
Okay, well, that exhibit, 1001 Inventions, is at the Science Museum in South Kensington now. We're going to finish up today with a few more questions for our guest, biochemist Nick Lane. As this programme is closing, let's talk about death, Nick. Mm-hmm. One of your 10 chapters is death. Without death, you say, evolution can't happen. Explain more.
Well, it's simply turning the old adage, survival of the fittest, on its head. If the fittest survive, then the least fit don't survive, they die.
They have to die, otherwise
You can't have evolution without death.
And so this is not only death in terms of cell death, which is a very useful function if you want to keep living, because damaged cells should die, otherwise they become cancerous or cause damage in some way to the larger body, but we're talking death of the organism itself.
Well, the focus of the chapter was on death of the organism and aging and what we can do about it, but part of this is exactly about cell death, which is very much an invention in a more conventional sense, simply because all cells, even bacteria, quite simple bacteria, are capable of killing themselves using a whole cascade of enzymes encoded in the genes and so on. It's called programmed cell death, and it has very deep ancient roots.
Fundamentally, this is all about transmitting that DNA from one thing to another. The bodies are just vessels along the way, as Dawkins
might
have said.
I would tend to see it that way. There are other ways of seeing it, but I tend to see it Dawkins way, yes.
I've just got a bit of a basic question for Nick about aging that's always puzzled me. Well, obviously, we know our cells will turn over, and we read about how at any given time it's actually then becomes quite interesting to work out what our biological age is, because all the cells in our bodies aren't as old as, you know, our birth certificate would suggest. So how old are we? How do we work out how old we are? And does that really matter? Because we still all die at sort of 75 or 80. So it makes me think that this whole idea that our cells are turning over and therefore maybe my leg is only 15 years old doesn't really matter. It's still, like, you know, older than that.
Well, life itself does not age, if you like. It simply evolves. And the same could be plausibly true of an organism. If you replace all the cells in the same way that the organisms are replaced in life, there's no real call for that organism to die. And there's some organisms, very simple ones like Hydra, which do not die, I think, as they're effectively immortal. I think death in this sense comes with complexity. And the more complex you are, and specifically as soon as you develop a complicated central nervous system and you've got all these neuronal connections, you can't really turn over neurons very easily without losing the connections between the synapses, which are formed by experience. And so you become a different person if you try to replace those neurons. And the various evolutionary playoffs just mean it's not worth it.
Thanks, Nick. Remember, Nick's book, Life Ascending, is published by Profile Books and is out now. My thanks also to Robin McKee and Ian Sample for their sharp insights this week. This podcast was produced by Pascal Wise. I'm Alok Jha. Thanks for listening.